And on our minds, Christians around the world are celebrating Easter this week, so we're revisiting an interview with Harvard Divinity School historian Karen King about the life of Jesus. And she's especially interested in the early Christian texts, the ones that didn't make it into the Bible, and she believes they give us a fuller understanding of what it means to be a Christian.
Part of what I do, of course, is look at the broad shape of early Christianity, not just those materials that made it into the canon, but also these new discoveries we have. And for me, what they do is they allow us to hear alternative voices. They allow us to read the Bible fresh, if you will.
When you talk about new discoveries, you're talking about the Dead Sea Scrolls?
When I talk about new discoveries, I'm thinking mostly of Christian texts we've discovered in Egypt over the last century or so, primarily a set of materials discovered at a place in Middle Egypt called Nag Hammadi. There, a peasant found a set of 13 papyrus books hidden in a jar in the desert. And these are really revolutionizing our notions of what Christianity looked like, especially in the 2nd to 4th centuries. These are mostly early Christian texts that show us the path not taken. In a way, the winners get to tell the story their way, you know, and silence other voices. And these texts are giving us, restoring to us, some of those alternative lost voices.
Do these new texts cover some of the most standard ground of the New Testament? I mean, for instance, take the story of the resurrection. How many different versions of the resurrection are there?
Oh, I'd have to sit and think to count how many different versions of the resurrection. But the new texts do have some new accounts of the resurrection, but mostly they have new interpretations of what the resurrection is about. One of the most astonishing texts is one that Apocalypse of Peter, which suggests that the Jesus who was crucified on the cross is different from the cosmic Christ, the revealer. And it goes on to talk about the way that the body is not the self. Many Christians understood the resurrection of Jesus to be a spiritual resurrection.
I thought that was kind of a very recent way of interpreting the resurrection. I guess I thought that in the days of early Christianity, the resurrection was always understood to be a literal physical event, you know, that Jesus appeared in the flesh 3 days after his crucifixion.
I think this is one of the ways in which when we read the Bible, we already know what it says, so we read it into the texts. But if you look very carefully at what kind of body Jesus has when he rises from the dead, it walks through walls. He appears in locked rooms. The people closest to him in his life don't even recognize who he is. But the earliest accounts we have a very ambiguous body. One has to ask, what kind of body is this? From the very beginning, there were notions that the resurrection was a spiritual resurrection, not one that was a physical bodily resurrection.
Did early Christians all pretty much down the line believe that there was a resurrection?
I think that's pretty universal. And the question is only, what kind is it? With what kind of body will we rise? And even more than that, what does it mean? Why did God want his son to die and to be raised? What is the meaning of that? Those were the things that they were most interested in and debated very, very strongly.
Well, for centuries, one of the chief articles of Christian faith has been the belief that Jesus died to atone for the sins of humanity. Was that how it was always understood among those first early Christians?
You get that idea very early on because, of course, the Greco-Roman world is a world where the practice of sacrifice is very broadly practiced, and this notion of atonement comes in very early. But we can see that not everyone agreed. Not everyone thought that that was the proper way to understand the death of Jesus. And in particular, there were Christians who questioned whether a good and loving God would want his son to suffer such a cruel death.
Well, if they didn't interpret Jesus' death as a form of atonement for humanity's sins, then how did they interpret it? Why did Jesus die then?
One notion is to show that the powers of the world are not in control, that God is in control. Another kind of view is precisely to show that one should concentrate on the spiritual aspects of life and not on the physical. Jesus comes into this world as a revealer, and it's his teachings that bring salvation, not his death and resurrection.
You know, listening to you, I just have a glimpse of what an incredibly knotty, tangled thing it must have been for the early church fathers to codify Christian faith.
Well, it was a long process. One thinks of it happening over a period of 3 or 4 centuries. And, of course, they only really come to a kind of an agreement when Constantine, the Roman emperor, converts, calls the bishops together and tells them to sit down and solve their difficulties. Now, part of it, of course, is only some people got invited, so they were already somewhat on the same page when they arrived, and they simply excommunicated anybody who disagreed.
Some of these things that we take as basic articles of faith, in fact, were very political decisions.
Yes, political in the sense that they were contested, that power relations was at stake, who was in charge, what communities would look like, who would be cast out as heretics, who would get to gain from Constantine, who gave a lot of financial aid in various kinds of ways to the churches. So, yes, politics were involved, even though I think we don't want to reduce it to that.
This raises a fundamental question, don't you think, about how we should read the scriptures, and in particular, whether they can or should be taken literally. I mean, how do you sort out this question?
I think the question you raised about reading the scriptures is an important one, precisely because I think it's very hard to read the scriptures literally. We can look, for example, at the figure of Mary Magdalene. And most people, like myself, were raised with the notion that she was a prostitute. And now we're hearing that she wasn't, that this was something that was invented in the 5th century. We see it first in the sermons of Pope Gregory, for example. But my question is, why is it that nobody noticed that for 1,500 years, that the New Testament, which is our best and most reliable source about Mary Magdalene, doesn't say that she's a prostitute? Why did no one see that? Or, for example, in reading Genesis, I ask students to read it and then close their Bibles and tell me what it says. And inevitably, they say Adam and Eve ate an apple, that the serpent was a snake, that the topic is original sin. And then I ask them to open their Bibles again. And sure enough, no apple, no snake is the devil. There's no language of original sin. It's because, you know, the apple comes from Milton and so forth. So people tend to know what the text says ahead of time and read it in. And again, I think this is one of the most important things that these new texts can do, is they can make us go back and look at the text and say, what does it really say about Mary Magdalene?
Why do you think the story of Mary Magdalene is important today? I mean, I know it's very hot, very popular right now, but does she matter?
Mary Magdalene matters for a number of reasons, because she's one of the most prominent women in the biblical story. And insofar as the biblical story shapes so much about how people see the world, what they think is appropriate, and the roles of women in general, then she becomes important. So insofar as she's seen as a prostitute, or we have Mary the Mother, the Virgin, Mary Magdalene, the repentant prostitute, and these are the models of femininity we have. Now with the Da Vinci Code, we have a new model, you know, Mary, the wife and mother. But if we look historically, the role that we have the best evidence for is Mary Magdalene as a disciple and as an apostolic leader. And that, of course, makes a lot of difference. Instead of seeing women solely in terms of their sexuality, we can see women as spiritual leaders in their own right. The historical Mary Magdalene lets us have that and have that vision, that role model within Christianity for women's leadership in the church.
And then that raises, I think, an interesting question in terms of how do you then reconcile historical fact and faith? You know, I mean, what does it mean in this case to reclaim Mary Magdalene, to uncover the real historical facts about her? It's interesting historically, but is it interesting from a faith perspective?
I think it has to be. If faith is not based in what is true, then we're really in trouble. The religious life, for me, is best characterized as seeking. And faith is distorted, I think, when it's presented to us as blind obedience and authoritarianism, when one suggests that it's obvious what the Bible says, when it has been contested, and when, in fact, the interpretation of the Bible is precisely a place for the Christian to engage.
And what about for you personally? You're an observant Christian?
Yes, uh-huh.
And how do you connect your scholarly work and your own personal faith, or do those two connect?
Oh, they connect very clearly and very dramatically for me. I mean, the kind of work one does in history and in the study of theology and so forth requires a kind of honesty and courage to face the ambiguities and the contradictions in the tradition, not to settle for easy answers and authority instead of thoughtfulness and instead of evidence.
Karen King is a historian at Harvard Divinity School. Her books include The Secret Revelation of John and What is Gnosticism?